But it does bring up this thing about how powerful competition is as an idea and how easy it is for it to distract us from what it is that we do best.
The algorithms limit, or maybe they can't scale it, whatever the reason is, you almost have to spend some money to get the exposure you want for whatever it is you're posting.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Marketing Podcast here, episode number 44. This is Shaheen Khan with Doug Garnett, as usual. How are you, Doug?
I'm doing well.
All right. We managed to spend a good 2-3 hours before we got here, and we're still up for it, so this is great. But you had a nice cartoon to kick us off with, so please set it up.
All right. We're returning to Tom Fishburne today, the Marketoonist. You can find his work at marketoonist.com. This came out in the last couple of weeks, and you've got a meeting in a conference room with two whiteboards on opposite sides of the conference room. And on one whiteboard, it has customers with red arrows pointing in at customers, you know, the words. On the other one, it has the word competitors, and it's got bar charts for the competition. And there's a guy with a magnifying glass looking at the chart on the competitor whiteboard. And he says, "Of course I'm paying attention to this meeting on customer obsession. Hey, our market share changed by 0.001% this morning." And I mean, partly I liked it for that kind of ADHD squirrel moment of, "What, our market share? Of course I care about our customer. What, market share?" But as you and I talked about in the pre-show, Shaheen, I think you should kick us off with where this led you to think about.
Yeah, so I think we could spend the whole episode on this cartoon because it's got so many dimensions. Two episodes ago, we talked about See featuring their competition in their ads and whether that was a good idea or not. And then there was a Twitter exchange that ensued after you posted about it, about why you may want to just project your own strength rather than look like you're overreacting to competition. So my thoughts immediately went there. Mm-hmm. Are you reacting to competition or are you projecting your strength? And when you're having a discussion about customers, maybe that is really a better path to market share than tracking how your competitive standing is right now. But there are many other angles.
But I think it is tricky for business, especially, you know, we've got a lot of mythology around business about competition. Free markets are honored for competition producing the best results. And, you know, we hear a lot of things about competition. Businesses hire people who have sports backgrounds because they think that means they get better, quote, competitors. Intriguingly, the more you look at nature and evolution, the less clear it is that species compete. And in fact, in some surprising places, they've found different species cooperating. And as I've thought about it, I think even within a business, we spend a lot more time cooperating than we do competing within a business. But it does bring up this thing about how powerful competition is as an idea and how easy it is for it to distract us from what it is that we do best. And I'm with you, which is my sense is as a company, we should spend most of our time focusing on what do we do best? How do we do it better? Where do we send it? You know, how do we succeed with it? Than to spend that time obsessing about what the competition does well. Not that they're unimportant, but there's some balance to have there.
That's right. Of course, they also use the word obsession. So then you have to worry about, is this particular thing worth obsessing over versus just understanding and acting and doing the right things?
Well, that's true, because the myth of customer obsession has become big, you know, and should we be obsessing about our customers? Our customers are extraordinarily important as one of the many parts of doing business. Emphasis on there's many parts of doing business. If all you focus on is your customers, you also don't win by that either.
Right. So Michael Porter of Harvard Business School had a diagram that looked at suppliers, competition, alternatives, customers, and you're in the middle. Mm-hmm. And there's a circle inside that kind of makes you look at all of them. But if you look at customers and competition as two constituents, you also have suppliers, of course, as per the diagram, but you also have employees, you also have investors, and as we've discussed in previous episodes, every one of them needs its own marketing focus, employee marketing, recruitment marketing.
Well, and I think that's some of the challenge here. I think that you know, what we found is that masses of humans are easier to motivate with super simple ideas. But the other part is super simple ideas are, to some degree, always a lie. You cannot simplify as far as you want to and still be really maintaining the truth of it. And I think in companies, the truth is it gets hard sometimes for companies to realize that we're affected by all these different groups around us. Customers are critical. They're not everything. Competitors are critical. They're not everything. You know, our employees are critical. They're not everything. Our investors are critical. No, they're not everything either.
That's right.
I mean, there is nobody that is everything. Our job in business is to find the right balance amongst all those where we're successful. And it's an issue of balance more than it is an issue of, well, if we just focus on customers, that'll tell us everything we need to know. And the answer is, no, that's not it.
Right. So you could really pick one and say customers are really what I'm going to focus on. But then that leads me to look at all the other constituents because I have to in order to get that. So in fact, if you want to be competitively strong, maybe you do need to A, do all these other things, and B, maybe you need something not so simple that others can do too.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the problems. I laugh often that, you know, people look around for really clear, big ideas they're going to invest in. But if the idea is really clear before you invest in it, your competitor can invest in that as well. You know, success in business is found by discovering the thing that you can make strong that other people just might be ignoring because they don't know about it. And, you know, those are the things that really offer us tremendous advances.
Or better yet, they don't agree with it. So they let you keep doing. And after you're super successful, they're going to want to copy you. That's, by the way, has been happening in the AI world with the so-called GPUs, the chips that are made by NVIDIA mostly, but also an increasing number of vendors. They've been doing that for a long time. And they've been doing it in a way that everybody else knew, but they didn't really try to compete in a very strong way. Well, now they are.
Now the GPUs are the core of processing for AI. Yeah, they're all running around going, oh, I missed the boat.
Yeah, and now that NVIDIA's market cap is over $2.5 trillion, maybe I want a piece of that, right?
You know, odd way where that takes us to is the fact that your path forward, if you choose the paths that are obvious to everybody else, you're not going to find anything unique to you that gives you a serious advantage. Whether that advantage is for several years or, you know, a couple decades, it just depends.
Yeah, or building for 10 years before it pops, and now everybody sees the value of it. So the other thing with the cartoon was market share itself. And, you know, we have a whole raft of questions about that. Like, how accurate is that chart of market share?
Yeah, in my own work, because I was working mostly with things that were new, so markets are in uproar. There's a lot of stuff you can't predict about them. You don't know how people are going to respond to it. I have rarely found any need to pay attention to market share. Mind share, you know, if you look at brands and who customers are paying attention to, I found that very valuable to understand what's going on there. I have not found market share for myself tremendously useful. I think part of what happens with market share is if you have a massive, stable market, you can calculate market shares and they can be useful.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But I worry that in a lot of companies are running around looking at market shares when it really doesn't tell them anything and it doesn't lead to actions that they will advance with. And so market share is an interesting thing in those markets, but not useful for the company to get ahead.
Well, and if you're after a new category, which every company is, well, then by definition, there is no market because you just created a new category.
Well, which is, of course, one of the fundamental problems of market share is you have to know what the market is that you're taking
right.
the share out of.
That's
and
right.
So, you know, if you look at a whole group of people, we're all told, and wisely, that you got to pick the people that are going to grok your product the best, you know, where you'll have the best luck. Okay, so what market are we looking at? Are we looking at the total market of everybody that buys a computer? Are we looking at the people who
right.
buy a computer to support their time at college? Are we looking at the people who buy a computer because they need it in business? Are we looking at the people who need a laptop that goes on the airplane with them as opposed to the coffee shop with them? You know, those are all. And so which market are we looking at market share within? So that's why, I guess that's why I think it, like, the market has to be pretty stable and pretty well defined before you can really get to those. And market share, to some degree, feels to me like a secondary. Now, that may sound way too dismissive, and I don't mean it that way, but it is a secondary indicator, right? Because what do you have to do in the company? Deliver profits, units, revenues, and cash flow. And market share is an indirect indicator for those. It's not a direct connection.
Right, right. And then you reminded us in our pre-call about lumpy markets, where a few sales can sway the market share this quarter compared to next quarter.
Yeah, and I've seen, I mean, a lot of the numbers analysis that we've had done, you get a lot of things that, and you know, I'll go with an example that's not marketing related, but I think we can all understand, which is you'll see charts that'll show, here's counties in Nebraska, and they'll show maybe cancer rates by county. And you'll always look at those, there'll be some county that just has an outrageously high, you know, cancer rate. And so everybody immediately goes, oh my God, there must be some environmental crisis there or some reason for it. Turns out most often, I can't say every, most often, those are statistical anomalies, that it only takes one or two cases for that county to go from not bad to, oh my God, what's going on?
Right.
And it's a statistical anomaly. It's not real. So if you're dealing with markets that are small, you can see huge movement in those markets that is completely insignificant to your company. I think we talked about in the pre-show was I once sent a database for a customer client out to be analyzed by zip code. And so they looked at everybody who bought by their zip codes, and then the zip codes were lumped into DMAs so we could look at it against media spending. And it came back, and there were a couple DMAs that had huge skews. I mean, just huge skews, meaning a lot of people there. It's like, you know, far more than average people bought the product. They were the tiniest DMAs in the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were down at that level where 20,000 a year would flood the market with advertising. And so they were just tiny. On the other end, the absolute worst correlation happened in New York, in the DMAs of New York. And it was interesting. It came back and, you know, clients said, well, why are we spending any money in New York? And I had to double check and go look. But New York was actually the DMA where they had the most retail sales. So even though it was the lowest skew, New York is so massive, that's where the most of their retail sales were coming from. It really was the number one market in the country. So we just have to be careful with some of these things because they don't tell us always what we think they should. The other thought I had with this I want to throw in is he talks about the 0.001% market share change. In a very large market, that might be significant. But I do find a tendency, once numbers are available, people can obsess about tiny things that we should not be obsessing about. And you know, you and I talked quite a bit in the pre-show about indexes, and I can't really give a course in indexes here, but fundamentally what happens is you get some data back and you say, okay, here's people who drink scotch, and then you take your age groups and you match them against it, and you give each age group a number. And if the number is 100, that means that age group, everybody drinks on average the same as the national average. If it's below 100, then fewer people drink scotch than the national average. And if it's over 100, then more people drink scotch than the national average. And I've always had problems that people want to look at the little things. So I'd have clients that come back and say, well, you know, this, we had 102 for women and a 99 index for men. So therefore the market skews female. And what I tell my classes is everything between 95 and 110 is average. You know, You can't worry about some of these tiny things sometimes, that you have to learn whether small things are important. Now, in market share, if you're Pepsi-Cola, that might actually be a very significant thing. I can't tell you that, whether it is or isn't, but I think we have to beware that number changes like that become things we obsess about, like the indexes. I mean, once you go look at indexes, you realize what I should care about is stuff like a 70 shows that somebody buys far lower than average. And an index like 160 says that somebody buys far more than you would expect based on the average. Worry about the big stuff.
The big stuff,
not those little things in the middle. And I hate it when I get in discussions, a lot of them with ad agencies or clients, where we were bickering over an index change of one and just didn't matter. That's so far within the research error used to generate the indexes that it's meaningless.
Don't they talk about significant digits?
Well, you know, once you've converted it to an index, you've lost that. right? Mm-hmm. So they might in the original things. You know, so example, let's go back to the comic. The cartoon talks about a 0.001% market share. Well, if that's a market share, you can translate that into an increase in business. So you could say, oh, that's $5 billion worth of, you know, if you compare that to NVIDIA's total market value right now, we're talking about $5 billion. But if you're looking at, Kodak's total market value right now, that's 10 cents. And, it depends on context.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's a lesson there, too, that the mighty do fall occasionally.
Yes. Yeah, I forgot about that one.
So as a segue, did we just talk about a lot of small things or one big thing?
Perfect. Shall we talk about foxes and hedgehogs?
I would love to hear about that.
Good. Actually, here's what I think for our listeners, what I'll say is we looked at an article online or blog that somebody put out that talked about websites and how websites get content, people to read them and things like that. But as part of the article, the guy talks about foxes versus hedgehogs. If listeners aren't familiar with this idea or this distinction, it's actually been around for several millennia.
It's a title of a book, right?
Right. Well, it's been around for several millennia. Then Isaiah Berlin titled a book, The Hedgehog and the Fox.
Oh, so he didn't come up with the analogy.
Well, it says apparently it goes back to an ancient Greek poet who said a fox knows many things, but a hedgehog knows one big thing. You know, that in theory, that's what the translation is. And so it does seem to go back a long ways, but people usually attribute its reappearance to Isaiah Berlin because he popularized it. If you don't know Isaiah Berlin, he was a historian and philosopher at Cambridge, I believe, in the mid 20th century through the end of the 20th century, and very influential, really a brilliant guy. I have a very soft spot for Isaiah Berlin. I'll have to admit that up front. But one of the books he wrote was called The Hedgehog and the Fox, and it was a book that looked at Tolstoy. And in his definition, he said that hedgehogs view the world through the lens of a single defining idea, and foxes draw on a wide variety of experiences, and the world cannot be boiled down to a single idea for the fox. And he suggests that, and there's other people that suggest you can look back through history and look at people and how they act, and some people are more foxes, some people are more hedgehogs. What I've come to believe is it's not a question of best or worst or right way or wrong way. In fact, there's a guy, a historian who studied with Berlin, who has said, in fact, most people are some of each. And I think that's actually the real truth. But
there are also too many dimensions for a human. You could be one in one dimension and something else in another dimension, depending on your interests and your studies and such.
It hit us in business through the work of Jim Collins and his book, Good to Great. And I think that one's worth mentioning because he's, Good to Great, the theory was that he could go out and identify companies who had okay stock market returns for about 20 years. And then they have a big shift somehow and they become great with outstanding, consistent, outstanding quarter over quarter stock market returns. And he separated those into two groups of companies and only studied the people he decided were great. So we actually don't know if they all had the same things as the people who weren't great. But one of his conclusions was that all the great people were hedgehogs. And so he popularized it with that thing. The problem is there's a really serious logical problem in that declaration because you're now looking at highly wealthy, highly profitable companies, and you have not compared them against the companies that aren't, in any detail. So you actually don't know if their hedgehogness contributed to their becoming great. And you also don't know if being a hedgehog is actually one of the accidents of being a very large, successful company. In other words, early in its life, a company has to be a fox because it has to be finding and searching,
right,
looking for the thing that's going to make it be able to achieve the long-term stability at once. And then many companies, once they succeed, then will slough off a lot of the fox-like behavior and focus on maybe more hedgehog-like behavior. And so it may actually just simply be an accident of how he defined the companies, not anything that matters
or this is how you evolve if you're actually successful.
Also actually gets into the danger of success, which is to some degree, companies must always be foxes and hedgehogs both. And when companies become too dependent on being a hedgehog, they often become brittle and stop the developing that they need to get to their next level of success. You know, there's a danger in it. And of course, you know, Jim Collins, who I think is actually a very savvy guy, in writing the book, he wrote it to be dumb simple. And I actually think the book does a disservice.
In that sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you could push the analogy further, as the tweet in question did, by also mentioning magpies.
That's true. Well, actually, I thought it was pretty clever.
So it was funny.
Yeah, the tweet was about what makes content that succeeds. This author of the cheat tweet suggests that there's three kinds of people who are successful getting a lot of followers. The first are just naturally famous, and so people follow famous people. You know, it happens. And then he said there's a second group that just are magpies. They gather stuff they like, shiny things that they bring back to their nest and they put out to people. And doing that consistently at high volume over a very long period of time can end up giving them a large following. None of it because of what they actually think, but because they're good collectors of shiny baubles. And then he names a third type, which is that there's a, you know, the remaining group struggle to remain honest. And if they're lucky, their followers grow while they're also honest. I'm a little less dismissive in the middle. I think curation is a skill, and the ability to find a consistent set of things to bring to other people's attention is actually a pretty good.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of it has to do with what your objective is being on social media. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to keep in contact with a group of people that you like and you respect, and they get to know you after a while. So that's basically like my participation in the marketing part of social media. And I like it. So there are those who really don't set out to be celebrities, and there are those who feel like they need to, or that's actually their objective. So then it sways you in that direction.
Well, and you just said, raises a question, Matt, how important is it to have large masses of followers? And there is a funny thing I've heard about recently, and I don't know, I haven't seen a lot of proof of it, but some people are having an experience where the more followers they have, the less interaction with a core set of followers they get. So there's a negative thing that possibly happens on Twitter. That was on Twitter, the one that somebody wants us to call X.
Right.
I'm trying to figure out a clever word for it.
Well, I'm delighted the media has stopped translating what the name of the company is and what it used to be. But there's something to be said for followers, for someone who really has consistently good content.
Yeah.
That the general community should really be exposed to and take advantage of, but they had been discovered.
That's the good thing with followers, is it can get content and ideas out further than they would otherwise. I think a lot of people come to it in terms of goals, you know, wanting to use Twitter to build their business, in which case it seems like you've just got to get more followers. And that's hard, you know. I'm not sure. That's a tough way to find success, because at least, I remember a story out of Jim Lyon's book about his time at HubSpot. He wrote a blog that was the most highly read blog in a HubSpot history. And it might even still be today. And yet it converted really badly. So it was highly readable. People really wanted it, and it had nothing to do with getting leads.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, I think social media presents us with a quandary. If it becomes our primary way to try to generate business or, you know, visibility or fame or whatever it might be, you know, the metrics and the reward system doesn't necessarily play into what's going to make a good business for us.
Yeah. Well, of course, what we were talking about is the flip side of that is because these days you're not going to get the exposure because the algorithms limit, or maybe they can't scale it, whatever the reason is, you almost have to spend some money to get the exposure you want for whatever it is you're posting. And in fact, one way to get that exposure is through celebrities and influencer marketing who've already got to that point.
Yep. Which gets into, when we talk about Burger King, you know, it gets into market borrowed glory. It's a really valuable thing.
So maybe on that highlight, we can conclude this episode.
Sounds good. Thank you, Shaheen.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Until next time, take care.
That's it for this episode of The Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of Orion X. Thank you for listening.